Good afternoon. Good afternoon. We have 1:30, and we have a lot to talk about. We are in the sixth parak of Ezra. If you're using the stone Tanakh, we are going to be at the top of page 1827. Ha, have we ever made progress? We started out this year way, way back on page 815. We've made progress. This makes EO look like, I don't know. Okay. This is week 17. I always put the number at the top of the sheet. That's how I know. So, you asked that also. We're gonna be in verse 11. Last time round, we spent a lot of time trying to figure out what the story is with King Darius, because remember what happened? Tatanai, the governor, said these Jews are building. Who gave them the right to build? The Jews said, we actually lost the paperwork. We do have the right to build. We were told that it was okay to do. Cyrus even gave us back the vessels for the temple, and we had the Pecha working with us, and we're all on the up and up, honestly. However, we don't have the papers, and so Tatnai says, that's okay, you can keep on building, I'm just going to send back to headquarters to find out what's going on. And they go hunting through the original headquarters first in Babel. They don't find it there. And then they find it in Elam. We talked about where they found it exactly and why it may have been moved. And the document, sure enough, says that Cyrus says you're allowed to build, and this is how you shall build, and he gives them even the structure. We noted the differences between the version in Cyrus in chapter 1 and the version found in chapter 6. And then Darius says, I'll go you one better. Not only am I going to allow you to build, and not only am I going to fund the building, but it's going to come out of your local tax dollars instead of the tax dollars going to the federal government in Persia. The tax dollars will stay local and be used for this temple, and we're also going to fund the karbanos. All the offerings, for an undefined period of time, are going to come out of the royal budget. You don't have to worry about a thing. And that's very impressive, so impressive that the Gemara says, can't be. There's something else going on here. And we gave a few different explanations for why Darius does this. We suggested that it might be religious motivation, especially within the idea that Cyrus was predicted by Yeshaya, by Isaiah, and that gives a sense of divine mission. Plus, we noted that Cyrus told the Babylonians, when he licensed them to build their temple, that their God had selected him. So maybe there is this sense of, I am the fulfillment of your messianic dreams. That could be. A second explanation is that it was political, because we said that at this period in history they're dealing with revolts from various minority populations. Maybe that's what this is about. Let's bribe them, essentially. A third approach was that he was trying to honor his predecessor Cyrus and the Achaemenid dynasty in general. And then the fourth explanation, which is the one that the Gemara goes into, is that it's selfish. He's doing it for himself. We went through that whole background Gemara about whether Darius and Cyrus were viewed like kosher kings, the restaurant aside, or not. And that brought us to the actual decree, which we read through, where they are told that they're allowed to even have materials for karbanos for their offerings, and we're at the very end of that decree. We're in chapter 6, sentence 11, with a remarkable additional note from Cyrus. So we're going to finish up Cyrus's decree. Then we're going to see them actually building the Beis HaMikdash, building the temple, and then we're going to get the party when they dedicate the Beis HaMikdash. And for that, we're going to have to do a lot of reading. So let's start first with the decree. Again, it's chapter 6, sentence 11. If you're using the stone Tanakh, you want page 1827. Uminisim te'im. He says, here is my order. Dichol enosh diyahashne pisgama dina. If anybody veers from this decree, right? Yahashne, like the word lishanot, shinui. If anybody does differently, if anybody does not follow this decree, yis nisach a min baisei, wood will be taken from his house. Yis nisach, like hesach hadas, the gap. The wood will be taken from his house, uzkif yismechei alohi, and he will be hung from it. Right? We just had Purim. Think Haman. That's the decree. We're going to hang anybody who tries to prevent the Jews from building this temple. Now we understand why they complied. But he isn't done. Uvaise nivalu yis aved aldina, and his house will be laid waste. So we're going to destroy his house, and we're going to kill him if anybody does this. Now, is that literally what they're planning to do? So take a look at Mitzvot David in source number 1 on your sheets. He says, Onsho yeah, his punishment will be Asher Yakar Eitz Min Beiso, a wood will be uprooted from his house, Velisloso Bo Yusam Vislu Alav. It will be set up to hang him and he'll be hung on it. Vahumi Derech Ium of Azhara Yisera. What this really is, though, he says, is it's a threat. It's an exaggerated warning. She and Nisla Allah Eitz Asher Yakar Mi Beiso, to hang him on the tree uprooted from his own home. In other words, Mitzudat David, I think, is hedging a little bit as to whether this was actually meant to happen. Are we really doing this? Ibn Ezra actually renders it a little bit differently also and suggests that it's that his house will be torn down rather than that we're going to hang him. But this is a very harsh warning to present. The idea of it, I think, is very strong, and I will note for you that Mikra refers you to a pasuk in Zechariah. If you take a look at Zechariah Perek Hey Pasuk Dalet, chapter 5, sentence 4, if you're using the stone Tanakh, it's page 1413. Keep in mind, when does Zechariah live in relation to our story? Chapter 5, sentence 4. I put it on the sheet. If you look at number 2 on your sheet, you'll see it there. But when does Zechariah live in relation to what we're seeing in Ezra? He's now. Zechariah is now. Zechariah is contemporary to this story. So keep that in mind. Sorry?
Second year of Darius.
Yeah. I mean, Zechariah prophesied in the second year of Darius. So as we saw that in the beginning of chapter 5. But if you take a look in this passage here in Zechariah, you find a malach speaking to Zechariah, because malachim do that, and the malach predicts the punishment as you see. The article gives you a helpful note in the margin, retribution to the wicked. So lo and behold, he says, the Hotseisianu Mashem Tzvakos Uva'a El Beis Haganov, the curse is going to come upon the house of the thief. The house of the one who swears in God's name falsely. It will sleep, literally, within his house. And it will destroy it. It will destroy the wood. It will destroy the stones. In other words, Zechariah is predicting that those who have sinned against God will have their houses be destroyed. So it's possible that this was sort of a standard punishment back in the day. Right, we think about it in terms of the headlines today and the issue of the terrorist house and so on. But this was a known punishment back in the day, sufficiently that Zechariah predicts it for those who sin against God, and Darius invokes it for those who fail to fulfill his command that the temple should be built, or those who try to veer therefrom. Yes.
If we think this is really a letter from Darius, which we think it is.
Yes.
Then it can't be an exaggeration, because it's actually an order being given at that point.
It could be a euphemism. Like when you say to your kid, I'm going to kill you. You're not going to touch it.
Saying to your kid.
My daughter is here. Okay? So be careful.
The problem is it's not saying to your kid.
Let the record show I didn't say that.
It's an order being given by the crown. At that point,
but it's still
two officers of the crown.
I mean, it's true. You don't put things in royal decrees that you know, and then say, "Well, I was just joking," or "I just meant that for a fact."
You go to their letter. It's a sealed letter from the emperor.
Well, it's not sealed. It's an open letter.
No,
I mean it's stamped. Yeah. No, I understand. It is a little bit odd to see it as an exaggeration when it is in a royal document. at the same time, you look at it and you think, wow, a penalty like that from the king of the Persian Empire, when he's already gone way above and beyond just having them build this temple. And again, this feeds into the Midrashim that Daryavesh is the son of Ahasuerus. The idea that there's no way that he would be going this far if he didn't have a personal stake in the matter.
Or it begs the question, is this a literal statement from him, or is this Ezra writing?
Right, and that's and that has fed into the view of the critics, who will say that this is actually Jews putting this into it. However, as noted in Encyclopedia Mikraït, the hallmarks of this letter fit the hallmarks of Persian letters to the extent that we have them. So if it's forged, it's done by somebody who knows what he's doing, is what I would say.
The Cyrus scroll is different than what Ezra says Cyrus wrote.
Correct, and we talked about that last week. Right, we did, or 2 weeks ago. We did note that. All right, Jeffrey and then Ari. Yeah.
Oh, but that's the whole idea of cursing the house is not like Taras.
It sounds like it, doesn't it? The idea of Saras, where a person has marks appear on his house and it's considered a sign from God that the house should be condemned, such that if the marks persist, they will actually pull that out, and then if it persists even afterwards, then we'll actually knock down the house. So there is this idea in general of the condemnation of the house of the sinner. I think you're right.
How does Darius know that?
Well, he learned it in Cheder, no? What do you mean? No, I don't think Darius has to know that. In the same way that Zechariah talks about this.
It's for our...
No, but what I'm suggesting is that it could be this was a penalty that was known in those days, but it does have this Jewish element to it, for us. Ari?
Well, I think that we should be careful when we criticize it to not look at it with the 21st century eyes. And with Western twin, if you go to Iraq and Persia today, they still kill people like for nothing. And even if it was an exaggeration, even if Ezra wrote it as exaggeration, everybody else would be just as smart as we are. We say, hey, that's an exaggeration. So I think that that's the reason.
You think it may just be like, yeah, this is what happened. Steal something, we cut off your hand, and, don't obey the king's order and lose your house. I can't argue against it. I don't know enough of the Persian criminal code. But it might be worth looking into. Okay. So, Pasuk Yud-Bet, sentence 12. Closing line of Darius' letter. Ve'laka de'shakin shmei tama, and God whose name resides there in the place of the Beis HaMikdash, in the place of the temple, yimagar kol melech va'am di'ishlach yedei la'shnaya l'chavala beis elaka dechti b'yushleim. He will crush any king in any nation who will send forth their hand to destroy this temple that they're building in Jerusalem. Ana Daryavesh Sameth Taim, I, Darius, have given the order, Asparna Yisavid, and let it be done immediately. End of quote. Thus spake Darius. So that brings us to the completion of the building. So what we're going to do now is look at the rest of this segment here, Psukim Yud Gimel to Yud Ches, sentences 13 to 18, which are going to describe the completion of the building as well as the dedication, and then we'll have to go through it slower. But let's just read the Psukim themselves. Edayin, at that point, Tatnai Pachas Avar Nahara Shtar Boznai Uchnavas Hon, right? Poor Tatnai, the governor, who made the mistake of writing away with a question in the first place. The Pacha of this area called the other side of the Jordan, as well as Shtar Boznai. I think we've decided that Shtar Boznai is probably one word. That's one name. Uchnavas Hon and their allies. Lakavel di Shalach Daryavesh Malka Kinema, when Darius sent, as we've just said, right? Kinema is like Kinemar. Asparna Avadu. They acted quickly. Good move. Vesave Yehudaye Banayin Umatzlechin. And the elders of the Jews built, they were successful, Benevuas Chagai Neviu Zechariah Bar Ido, at the word of here they are, Chagai and Zechariah, as we mentioned at the beginning of this segment, the beginning of chapter 5. Uvno v'shachlilu min tam eloka Yisrael. They built, they reinforced it, and if when we started reading this pasuk, you didn't note which pasuk this is. This is chapter 6, sentence 14, which we spent so much time on back in chapter 4. This is the verse that gives everybody fits. They built and they reinforced by the order of the God of Israel, Umitzaim, and by order of Koresh, Vidaryavesh, Ve'artachshasta, Melech Paras, by the order of Cyrus, Darius, and Artachshasta, the Persian king. Singular. Oh boy. So that means we're going to have to dive right back into chapter 4 again. But before we do, V'sheitzi Baisa Dina Adyom Tlasa Lirach Adar. The house is completed on the third day of the month of Adar, Dihi Shnas Sheis Lamalchus Doyavish Malka, year 6 of King Darius. So when people talk about Mishenichmas Adar Marbin Besimcha, right, that Adar is a good month for us, it's not only about Purim. The third day of Adar is the day when we finish building the second Beis HaMikdash, the second temple. That's a very serious day, or it should be a very serious day on our calendar. Serious in a good way. V'avadu b'nei Yisrael kahanaya v'levayeh u'shar b'nei galusa chanukas beis eloka dina. So the Kohanim, the Levim, all the exiles make a dedication of this house of God b'chedva, with joy. It's an unusual word to use for simcha in Tanakh. Usually we say simcha, and we do even in this book. Chedva shows up here and there, perhaps Vayichad Yisro, when it says that Yisro Vayichad, when he heard all of God had done for the Jews, it's usually taken as trembling, but it could be taken as also having joy. So they brought as korbanos for the dedication of this house of God, torin me'ah, 100 oxen, dichrin masayin, 200 rams, imrin arbama'ah, 400 sheep, utzvire izin, and young goats, lechata'ah al kol Yisrael. The word lechata'ah is not a clear word. We're going to render it right now as to atone for all Israel. Trei asar leminyan shivta Yisrael, 12, one for each tribe. V'hakimu chahanayev beflugas haon v'leivayev b'machlokas haon. They established the Kohanim with their divisions, the Levim in their ships, al avidas eloka di Yerushalayim, on the service of God in Jerusalem, kichsav sefar Moshe, as is recorded in the book of Moshe. End of section. Lots to talk about here. What questions do we have to have when we read this? No? It's all clear? That's good. Make my job easier. I got a bunch of questions. First of all, who are these king? Right? When we list three names, but they're all the Persian king. It doesn't just, you know, a phrase. It means the Persian kings. Even if I am okay with that.
It's three generations.
It's three generations, but we haven't actually met Artaxasta yet. Or have we met Artaxasta yet? Right? You mention here Cyrus, you mention here Darius, and then you mention Artaxasta. So we did have Artaxasta mentioned back in chapter 4 in this weird interlude that we read about in chapter 4, sentence 7. So is that this Artaxasta? Very unclear, because that Artaxasta, what did he do in that interlude in chapter 4? What did Artaxasta do? Well, not nothing. He stopped the construction. But chapter 6, sentence 14 says they built it on the order of Artaxasta. There were two Artaxastas. Wasn't it bad enough we had one person Artaxasta?
Well, I'm a sheep here.
Sorry?
Chapter 4.
Yes.
On the sheet, there's two?
So that's the question: is maybe there are two people named Artaxasta, Francis?
Maybe that's not his name. Maybe that's we discussed what's before that might be terminology for that.
So maybe it's a title. But if it's a title, how do you read the sentence? Cyrus and Darius and the title. Very difficult read.
And Xerxes seems to be missing.
Well, that depends. Who is Xerxes? If Xerxes is courage, I'm just fine. It's a colossal mess.
Isn't there someplace else that says Artaxerxes stopped the building?
So if you take Artaxerxes to be Artaxasta, then yes.
Right.
The problem is it? This doesn't work easily. I also want to know why you're bringing so many Karbanos.
Well, all the people from the Golah, you know, from Babel have come up.
Where do you have precedent it's for bringing 100 of this and 200 of that and 400 of that?
It says
Solomon, maybe.
It's written in Torah.
No, it says the divisions are written in Torah, which is its own question. Where do you find the divisions of the Kohanim and Levim recorded in the Torah? Here's a clue, you don't. So what is that even talking about? So let's go through this and see what we can figure out.
And by the way, Darius is paying for this.
Yeah, by the way, that's right. This is now I understand why you have so many carbonos. It's on the house. Yes. Okay. Hey, look, it's our tax dollars. The chapter 6, let's go back to the beginning of this. So Tanai and crew complete very quickly the royal order of assistance. Good idea. And they completed by order of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxasta on the 3rd of Adar of the 6th year of King Darius. So the first problem that you have to deal with is just the fact that they've been presented on equal footing with God. Right? If you look at the language in chapter 6, sentence 14, it said they did this by order of the God of Israel and by the order of these Persian kings. So the Malbim deals with that problem. If you take a look on your sheet, it's source number 3.
This is a different translation, by the way.
Yeah, what do they have?
It said under the aegis of God of Israel and by the order of King X, Y, and Z.
That's interesting. The word in the Aramaic is the same. Tom is the same word.
Okay, well, that's
JPS is trying to solve the problem.
Right.
JPS is saying you can't possibly equate God with Persian kings, no matter how nice and benevolent they are. So therefore, when the word Tom is used for God, it means supervision of. When the word Tom is used by the king, it means the order of. So the truth of the matter is that I would make a lot more fun of the JPS for doing that if Malbim hadn't done it first. If you take a look at source number 3, Shaya hashgacha meutefes biteva. This was divine supervision cloaked in nature. Shaya mitam elokei Yisrael inyan hashgachi. It was by order of the God of Israel in the sense of supervision. Avalo neis nikla, but it wasn't an open miracle. Rak mitam hamalachim. It was by order of the kings. Shenasan Hashem kazos belibam. In whose hearts God puts this. So Malbim did what JPS obviously took from there, which is that you have to retranslate Tom, because otherwise you're saying this rather offensive thing about God, that somehow it's the equal of what they did. Okay. Right, well, that's where we're going next, is the question of, so who exactly are these kings we're talking about? And we're going to give 4 different perspectives, just like we did when we first discussed this regarding the problem of Artaxasta in chapter 4. Our first approach is Malbim, source number 4 on your sheet. And Malbim takes the view, we've seen this before, that Melech is literal. One man, 3 names. Remember we read the Gemara that said Artaxasta is Cyrus, is Darius? So Malbim's take is that that's meant literally. That the Gemara means... I mean, every time I read the Gemara and every time I read Rashi, I think Malbim just read the Gemara wrong. I can't accept his read of the Gemara. But that's what he said. He believes one human being. Take a look at source number 4. Lidas Chazal v'Rosh Hashanah, in the view of our sages in the Gemara and Rosh Hashanah that we saw last week, Hu Shem Echad. It's one name. V'chem Pirish Rashi. And so Rashi said, he believes Rashi said, Shartachshasta Hu Daryavesh. That Artaxasta is Darius. V'nikra Ken al Shem Malchus. He gets the title of Artaxasta because of the empire, meaning it's the Pharaoh of Persia, the Artaxasta of Persia. V'chem Mashakasuv. And when it said back in chapter 4, this was in the days of Artaxasta, Pirish Rashi, Shuka Resh Rashi said this was Cyrus, Shekachi Das Chazal, that's the view of the sages. So Malbim says that what the Gemara believes is that these are all one person. Artaxasta, Cyrus, Darius are actually one human being, which means that it was one human being who allowed the construction in the first place when he took the throne, who then was convinced in chapter 4 by the Samaritans not to allow them to go forward, and then who changed his mind in chapter 6 and said, go ahead, don't worry about it. They keep right on building. Which is, I hate to say it, but absurd. Why is it absurd? Because in chapter 5, Tatnai wrote away to the king and said, I heard there's an order by some king saying they should build. And he said, I don't know anything about this. Let's look it up. I don't understand. It was your order.
Yes,
it's like bringing Achashverosh to new heights. It was during my 6-month party. You expect me to remember? It just doesn't work. That was why. Remember Malvim's whole explanation about the scribes and how they're coloring the wording of the letter that they send in chapter 4? That was because he was bothered. How could the scribes write a letter to Cyrus who permitted the building and lie about what's going on? So he came up with this way that they colored it, they wrote it in a way that it was ambiguous. It's all because he believes it's one king on the throne the entire time. That's Malvim's perspective. However, it's not the only read of the story. Because even though it's true that Rashi in chapter 4 did give you that cute gematria, that Cyrus in gematria is the same as Darius, right? You remember that? If right, Kafreshin for Koresh, it's the same as Darius. Nonetheless, Rashi makes it very clear here that that's not what the Gemara meant. And Rashi on the Gemara makes it clear that's not what the Gemara meant. Rather, what the Gemara meant was that there is a royal title called Artaxasta. Cyrus was the original Artaxasta in this Achaemenid dynasty. Darius came along and he was so good to the Jews that the Jews sometimes called him Cyrus, like he's a second Cyrus. It was the way we looked at him. But not that Cyrus and Darius are the same person. When the Gemara says he is he, because remember what the Gemara was trying to solve. The Gemara's problem was chronology of kings. And they had equated Cyrus and Darius. And the answer is, yeah, we equate them because they were both wonderful to us. He was as good as. Exactly. This is a second Abraham Lincoln for us. You know, that kind of, or, I don't know, John McDonald. That's the idea. Yes?
It seems to me that there's a king at the beginning who's good to the Jews.
Yeah.
We're calling him Cyrus.
Yep.
And there's a king at the end who's good to the Jews. We're calling him Darius.
Yes.
There's somebody in the middle who's not so good to the Jews.
Maybe. Maybe. If you take the view that Achashverosh is in between
and
these kings.
In this one.
When you say someone in the middle, do you mean from chapter 4?
What I'm saying is, in the events as we understand them.
Yeah.
Right? We know that Koresh sent them home.
Yeah.
The beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And we know from this letter here that Darius supports the idea of the building of the temple, big time.
Yeah.
Someone, somehow in the middle of it, either changed their minds, and we don't seem to have a record of that when they're looking at the record
right.
support for it, curiously. And then somebody changed their minds again, second time, to allow them to do it.
Yes.
The character in the middle, and it's interesting because the Artaxasta is described chronologically in this time is the third of the emperors.
Yes.
He comes after Darius.
Right. Which is no problem if you believe Artaxasta is not a person, it's a title.
Yeah, exactly. They both have this title.
Yes.
But there's something missing in the middle. Because something in the middle for I think it's 18 years.
Possibly. Yeah.
You know, stop the building.
Right. So there are two ways you can do this, right? One approach, which is the approach that the classic commentators, including Rashi and the Malbim, accept, is that story happened in the middle, and that Artaxasta was either, according to Malbim, Cyrus and Darius, same man, or according to Rashi, that Artaxasta is Darius himself, and Darius first blocked it and then licensed it. It's the same man.
So Darius is Achashverosh.
We didn't use the word Achashverosh.
No.
Deliberately, because there is no... The Achashverosh of the Purim story does not seem to appear in Sefer Ezra. We have one mention of Achashverosh that we saw in chapter 4, right. But we felt that was actually a reference to a later King Achashverosh from when they're building the walls of the city. Not necessarily the Purim Achashverosh. You have to remember, the Persians recycle these names. Right? There are multiple Xerxes, there are multiple Artaxerxes. I don't know why they couldn't just branch out in terms of names and not have to double up. And then it would have been like, I do know why. It's a thing. It's you're like the earlier leader. It gives you authenticity. I get it. Nonetheless, it really makes a headache for everybody afterwards. You thought they would have had an eye towards history.
Is
Malkin not bonded by the Vaz?
He should be. But no one is bothered by the Vavs. Meaning, even with Rashi's read, you know, let's see Rashi first and then come to the Vavs. Take a look at source number 5. Take a look at Rashi in number 5. Umerishus Koresh Melech Paras Harishon, by permission of Cyrus, first king of Persia. He's not really the first king of Persia, but he's the first king of Persia in our book, right? We know he's actually Cyrus the second. But in any case,
you could put Harishon together with Asher Ruchal, the first to start.
Oh, no, don't do that. Umerishus Koresh Melech Paras Harishon, Asher Ruchal Yisoda Binyan Biyamav, in whose day the foundation was established. Umerishus Daryavesh Zem Melech Paras, and with permission of Darius, who is the Persian king, right? So you can see so clearly, by the way, that he views them as two different people. He's not doing what Malbim is doing. V'artachshasta, who Daryavesh, and Artachshasta is Darius. V'nikra, Artachshasta, Shem HaMedina V'amalchus, he was called that because of the country and the empire. That's what you called your kings, like the Egyptians named their kings Pharaoh. So Rashi also is not bothered by the Vavs in Pasuk Yudalit. They all just sort of ignore the Vavs. And that's your second view. So we have one view that says all the kings in chapter 6, sentence 14 are one man, and everything should be read in order in Ezra. We have our second view, which is Rashi's view, that it's actually two. And then you have the Baal HaMa'or, Rabbi Zrachya HaLevi, who we read about already way back when in chapter 4, but I brought it for you again in source number 6 on the sheets. And he says that they are three kings.
Which is what Malbim later on said.
Right, Malbim mentions it also. Yeah. I'm fixing here on his quote of the Gemara, because he's the only one who reads the Gemara that way. But you're right, Malbim brings multiple suggestions.
So what's the term? And he says, I disagree with, he says, Perish HaNochon. For me, a better explanation is now what you mentioned.
Sorry?
What's the time span we're talking about here?
So we'll get to that, but it's basically 21 to 23 years. Source number 6, Rabbi Zrachya, it could have been one man in that sense, yes.
Why does this matter so much? Obviously, it's very important.
So, let me come back to that question after we see the different explanations. It's a good question. So, Zrachya Alevi in his Baal HaMa'or says, Zehu ha'ole biyadeinu lefi medrash rabboseinu lefi diktukeihem. He first gives you the explanation of the medrash, where the Gemara gives you all the different kings being one person, two people, and then he says, Avala perish hanachon, but he says the right view. There's no other way to say it. But he says, if you want to know what the verses actually are telling you, he says, Lefi apshat zesha kasuv, umiteim koresh v'daryavesh v'atachshas t'melech paras, shlosha malachim hayu. There are three kings. V'hayu kamo shamar malchei paras. He says, don't get caught up in the word melech. Kings, don't worry about it. It's like fish, right? You say fish, you mean multiple fish. You say fish anyway. Kichol echad mehem haya melech paras. Each of them was king of Persia. So that's what it's saying. Darius, king of Persia. Cyrus, king of Persia. Adachshasta, king of Persia. Vashnayim arishonim huskru le'inyin binyan abayis. And the first two who are mentioned are regarding construction of the house. Shekarash hayamatzcho v'dayavash hayamashlim. Starting in Cyrus's time, ending in Darius's time. And then the Baal HaMa'or says, you want to know who this Artachshasta is? It's not anybody we've encountered yet. It's the Artachshasta we're going to meet in the next chapter, in whose day they build the walls of Jerusalem. He's the one who's going to send Nehemiah ultimately to Israel to build the walls of Yerushalayim. This pasuk is a narrator sentence reflecting what we've already seen and what we are going to see. That's the way that he reads it. Ve'ein Artachshasta harishon shetziva levatam leches beis hamikdash. It's not your first Artachshasta, the one who stops us from building the beis hamikdash. Lefichach samchan akasav l'shlosha malachim halalu. Therefore, the pasuk juxtaposed each of these kings. Ve'iskiron b'zeachar zeh, mentioning them together in sequence. Lahazkir shivchan uzuchusan, to say these are the good guys. These are the Persian kings who we like. And so that's a third view, is that it's Cyrus and Darius from this stage, and Artachshasta, who we haven't actually discussed yet, we'll get to him later. Ralph?
Is it possible that these names represent qualities?
I wouldn't know how.
We'd have to know what they meant in Persian.
Right. I don't know. It's an interesting idea. I have no frame of reference for it. It's an interesting idea.
When did Rabbi
Zechariah? Rabbi Zechariah Levi, the Baal HaMa'or, is, I believe, 13th century. 13th, maybe 14th. I mentioned last time when we first saw him, his commentary is usually a halachic commentary and a Gemara-oriented commentary. It's found on the Rif. The Rif is Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, who is the Rebbe of the father of the Rambam. And you find where what he did was he went through the Gemara and he excerpted all the halachic passages from the Gemara in a step towards a code of law. And it's published in a standard Vilna edition of the Talmud in the back of the Talmud, and they have commentaries surrounding it. And one of the classics is the Baal HaMa'or of Rabbi Zrachya Halevi. You find him, well, that's enough for that. But that's a third approach. The last approach I'll mention, just for fun, is Ibn Ezra. Ibn Ezra says there are four kings involved. Because why not? He says, V'dar Yavesh hu hazakein hamadi, for those who learn Daniel. Remember, the sixth chapter of Daniel mentions King Darius the Mede, who is supposed to have partnered with Cyrus in beating the Babylonians, and Cyrus gives him the monarchy, and he reigns for 1 year. He's already 62 years old when he takes the throne. He reigns for 1 year, and then he disappears, and Cyrus takes over. So so he says the Darius who's mentioned here, fitting everything in chronological order, is Darius the Mede. And then Artaxasta is Ahasuerus. And for Malchus Daryavesh, for the reign of Daryavesh, that's Ben Ahasuerus. In other words, you have four people. You have Cyrus, Darius the Mede, Ahasuerus, who is Artaxasta, and Darius, the son of Ahasuerus. I mention that to you just for the sake of entertainment. Remember that Ibn Ezra, we've already seen this, Ibn Ezra in Ezra and in Esther contradicts himself in terms of who is who. So I feel no obligation to set him straight. But you can have four kings in this sentence. There was a hand in that area. Shana.
I'm delighted by the Baal HaMa'or. I'm shocked because there's three names, there should be three people. I'm not so bothered by the inclusion of Artaxasta, even though, according to the story so far, he was a negative. Because at this point, the project is complete. So you don't want him to be the one who failed to stop the project. So you include him as a courtesy to kind of not point him out as being the negative.
Right. Honorable mention.
Honorable mention.
Okay. I hear that idea. It's a good idea. So I come back to Debbie's question, which is, who cares? Okay, but it's my summary. Or my explanation. If you had one word, I put into two. So the answer, I think, is important on multiple levels. First of all, I want to understand the pasuk. I need some sense of what's going on. But second, if I want to believe, and I do, that Ezra is a coherent text put together by the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, by the Great Assembly, who are not living so far after these events as have no historical memory of what went on, I need to understand who is being referred to here and find where the texts are consistent with each other, or if they're not consistent, explain why they're not consistent. So for that reason, I need to get my story straight and explain the different words. If the answer could be, human beings did this without any divine inspiration and there could be mistakes in there, then I don't need to worry terribly about it. I can look at it and say, this is just a jumble and move on. But if I'm a believer in the legitimacy of the text as canon, as part of Tanakh, then I need to figure out, so how am I supposed to read these sentences?
If it's part of canon, then you're saying it's divinely inspired?
So the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah, the Great Assembly, are post Nevuah. There are among them Nevi'im, there are prophets among them, but the general assumption is that it's at least Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, whether it's prophecy or not, in terms of the canonizing of the books. So yeah, this is supposed to be right. And so I need to know. So how does it actually work? And that's one, that's a simple reason for me of why I need to figure out what's going on in this. Yeah, Ralph.
Is it possible to take this as being God inspires non-Jews to benefit Jews? And it's something that we should be aware of and encourage.
Can be. I'd like to think we're not using them. But certainly the idea that he's, in general, we have this concept that Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration, as the Rambam explains it, can be God energizing somebody to do something good, Jewish or non-Jewish. And in that sense, yes, that's something that will be consistent with our ideas, more broadly. So what we have Yeah, what we have at this stage are multiple ways to read chapter 6, sentence 14. But the bottom line is that one of two things happened. Either we started to build, the Samaritans blocked us. Eventually, we restarted under the Nevi'im, who ignored the fact that we had been blocked. And then we were licensed to do it by Darius. That's one version of what happened. That's the general view of the Mefarshim, of the commentaries, no matter what the name of the king was and how many kings there were. The other view, Dat Mikra, and the general historical view, was that chapter 4 was inserted there because it fit the theme, but it wasn't historically there. And according to this view, they started to build. They stopped because we got lazy. We were intimidated by the Samaritans. We stopped. Haggai and Zechariah said, get going. And we started to build. The Persians said, wait, who permitted you to do that? They did the research. They found we had permission. And Darius allowed us to build. And we completed the temple. Those are your two chronologies of the first six chapters of Ezra. Clear?
Second chronology, there's no... prohibition.
There's no official prohibition, which explains why, when they went researching, they didn't find any document against, and why we weren't afraid they would find a document against. There's a lot that's very appealing about that read, I have to say.
And that also explains Zachary and the guys get moving.
Yes. Yeah. Because why not?
Exactly.
Yes. Okay. So how much time did the construction take? Well, the construction itself, meaning the last stage of the construction, is 4 years. Year 2 of Darius to year 6 of Darius. That was easy, 4.5 years. And Rashi says that, Malbim says that. How long did the entire project take from beginning to end? So Dat Mikra says that we came back in year 1 of Cyrus. That's the year 539 before the Common Era, according to the historical count. We started to build in the second year after we arrived. The sixth year of Darius is roughly 515 before the Common Era, again, going with the historians and their system. So that would mean it took us basically 21, 22 years or so to do the entire thing, including the period when we paused, whichever reason we paused. Then we get the dedication. And for this, in order to understand the dedication, we have to put it in biblical context. So you're going to need your stone Tanakh now. I gave you all of the references on your sheet in source number 8 for you to be able to look up. The first stop is indeed, as was mentioned before, Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. Melachim Aleph, Kings 1, chapter 8. I believe I caught all of the dedications of temples. I may have missed one, but I think I got them all. So you want page 827 in the Stone Tanakh. Bottom of the page. So there is none. Meaning if you look in Yehoshua, there's almost no description of what they did. You're talking about the one in the Chumash.
Yes.
Not the one when they're actually in the land. Right, yeah. Then we have the 8-day period of the Miluim that goes on back then, which will be relevant for us. It will get cited. But yeah, I didn't think about that as part of this because it's not in the land itself. It is a dedication, though. You're right. So looking at sentence 62. You see that? V'amelech v'chol Yisrael imo zavchim zevach lifnei Hashem. The king with all Israel, they bring offerings before God. V'yizbach Shlomo zevach ha-shlamim asher zavach l'Hashem. He brought the shlamim, the celebration offerings. And here we go. Bakar esrim ushnayim elef. 22,000. Okay, that's a lot of cattle. V'tzon mea v'esrim alef. Sheep, 120,000. And they dedicated the house of God. It was the king and all Israel, which is why you needed so much. And then we get a further description about how they did all of this with the offerings and how he has to actually dedicate a new altar just to deal with the supply of offerings. That's dedication number one. How long did it take? A week. They do a week-long celebration. A week-long cell, yeah, a lot of Kohanim, and a lot of people eating. So yes. Then, we're going to jump to the end of Tanakh, Divrei HaYamim Bet, chapter 29, sentences 15 to 36. It is page 1999. They partied like it was. This is in the days of King Chizkiyahu. Remember that Judea, Yehuda, goes through periods in which you have kings who are corrupt and the temple falls into disrepair, and then you have righteous kings who refurbish it and rededicate it. So Chizkiyahu rededicates the temple. You see it here on page 1999 over onto the next page. And here, I'm not going to have us read the entire section in the interest of time, but take a look in verse 21. You see it there. Seven bulls, seven rams, seven sheep, seven he-goats, right? That's the offering that they bring, and then you get this whole long celebration that follows. Running down the page, I'm looking now at sentence 31, 32. And you get the burnt offerings, the olot, that they brought. 70 bulls, 100 rams, 200 sheep, right? And the other sacrifices, 600 bulls and 3,000 sheep. Okay, so now again, a celebration with many carbonos. This in the days of King Chizkiyahu. Clear? I apologize to the vegetarians. But that's Chizkiyahu's day. Then after King Chizkiyahu, who's the next king? Sorry? Menashe. Menashe is the next king after Chizkiyahu. Menashe spends 22 years leading the Jews into idolatry. He ultimately reigns for 55 years, tries for the latter 33 to lead them straight, as the Gemara explains. Fundamentally, after Chizkiyahu, we have more problems. Until we get to King Yoshiyahu. And once again, Yoshiyahu wants to rededicate the temple. And here we go to Chronicles 2, chapter 35. Yoshiyahu's dedication. And what you want is on page 2017. That's significant. And here you see, yet again, they bring a lot of offerings, right? 2,600 sheep for the Karban Pesach. It was Pesach, by the way. They actually, before that, sorry, you have 30,000 that he dedicates for the... how does it work? I'm reading the English. It's a lot harder. I'm going to go with the Hebrew. They have the Shloshim Aleph, 30,000 of these animals, of the sheep and goats, and then from the cattle they have another 3,000 that they're bringing, and then you get this further list of additional animals where you have Alpayim V'Sheish Meos, another 2,600 for the Karban Pesach, plus another 300 cattle, and then even more numbers as you go into Pasuk Tes. The bottom line is, you have a lot of offerings, a lot of Karbanos that are being brought. And then last, yeah, maybe, if you now go back to Yechezkel, Yechezkel prophesies for the Jews while they are in Galus, while they're in exile between the first and second temple, and he envisions the dedication of the temple, which is going to happen in the future. Chapter 43 in Yechezkel, you want page 1315. Okay, you're looking at sentences 18 to 27, where we're told about bringing karbanos, bringing special offerings. And there are no numbers, except to say you should bring this and you should bring that. And then on page 1321, verses 18 to 25, it continues. And here we are told again about the offerings that they are to bring, and I'm jumping to sentence 23, Pasuk Chaf Gimel. For the 7 days of the celebration, you shall bring seven bulls, seven rams, as well as a chatat, a goat, as a sin offering each day, and flour offerings to boot. You see that? That's what's supposed to happen in the future. So we have these multiple celebrations that are described. Shlomo did it, Chizkiyahu did it, Yoshiyahu did it, and then Yechezkel, Ezekiel predicts that it will happen again for a future Beis HaMikdash, for a future temple. Keep that in mind when we look at the celebration that they have in Ezra. So, take a look at back in Ezra, now. Okay, now that we've taken our tour.
Just before we leave here, though, so yeah. I'm seeing in verse 18, it says, take this sacrifice, the Kitesa and Amidash,
yes.
Which is going to deal with our problem maybe in Ezra, where it talks about the...
We will exactly have to get to that. You are quite correct. But we're not there yet. If you take a look back in Ezra now, on page 1827. Sentence 16. We're told, the Kohanim, the Levim, the rest of the exiles do Hanukkah's base alaka dinah, the dedication of this house of God. So, some people, specifically Malbim, you knew it would be Malbim, are bothered by the word this. Because Malbim is bothered by words like that. He picks up on everything. What do you mean this? Was there some other house of God you were thinking of, perhaps? So the Malbim says, yes, there actually is another house of God he was thinking of. You bet. Take a look, please, on your sheet at source number 9. He says, for Pirshu HaKadmonim, the early ones, and I don't know who he's quoting, but the early ones have already explained Mashakas of Abayis HaZeh, when it says, this house, ki im hayuzochem az hayam agiyaz man hageula ha'asida, had they merited it, the time of the future redemption would have come back then. V'tekef achar binyan zeh ha'yoreit beis hamikdash min hashamayim. And immediately after this, the temple would have come down from heaven, as in the big final beis hamikdash. Remember that there are two traditions about how the third beis hamikdash will come to exist. Rashi on the Gemara is of the belief that it's coming down in fire from heaven. The Rambam seems to believe we build it with our hands. Two different views, all based on psukim, based on verses. So what Malbim is adopting is the view that it comes down from the heavens. So he says that the idea was, we're celebrating for this house, but after this house, a future temple is going to descend from Shamayim, kemikta shara Yechezkel lazit lava, like the one Yechezkel envisions, for the future. And then you would have another dedication, like the one that Yechezkel foretold. Right now they did this one. Shemilas dina, it says this house, Morish Mitzvah, Chanukah's Bayis Acher, indicates that they were anticipating another one. And then he says something very interesting. If you look in Yechezkel, you find the dedication begins on the 23rd day of Adar. That's interesting. That Yechezkel's one is supposed to be then. So they started on the 3rd of Adar, and they went all the way till the 23rd, waiting for this to happen. 21 days of celebration going on. Had they merited it, it would have culminated in what Yechezkel envisioned, this great dedication of a house coming down from the heavens. And Malbim says that's why the text emphasized that it was bechedva, with joy. What do you mean? Source number 10, Malbim's. Well, no, Malbim says, Yan Shabiyamim Ha'ela Cha Purim, Shehem Yehem Mishta V'Simcha. Since these days include Purim, which have their own celebration and joy, Amar Shahaya Iker HaChedva Ala Chanukah Shahaysa Gedola Misimcha Sapurim. The point is to say they celebrated this with joy. It wasn't because they were celebrating Purim, it was because they were celebrating the dedication of the Beis HaMikdash. And clearly this is the chronology that assumes that Purim is happening sometime before this moment when you've dedicated the Beis HaMikdash, which is reasonable. But that's the way Malbim reads it. So he says, they bring these offerings as part of the celebration of the Beis HaMikdash. They're there for 3 weeks, he says, doing this. We know that it has to be done by Pesach, because Pesach is next part of the story. So that's our outer limit. But he says that's what they're doing. Yeah, Ralph.
Is this to suggest that the HaMikdash that they built was not proper? Was something wrong with it? It had to be superseded by one from heaven?
Well, if I have a choice between one that I built and one that God built, then yes, it's inferior. Not to mention, we saw last week, this one was an arsonist delight. Right? They had the possibility of the wood. So, you know, presumably Hashem is going to take care of code. And therefore we won't have those issues. So yeah, I would say so. Francis?
If it's an arsonist delight, though, why would Darius issue the decree that anybody who puts out his hand to destroy this will be dealt with post?
Right, because he's hedging his bets. In other words, the idea that it could be burned down is a safeguard for him. But it's not that he's against it right now.
He should see it, though, if he's going to say, yeah, this is what will happen.
No, but he's happy right now, but he's keeping watch, and he's ready to burn it down, too.
Nobody should burn it down.
No, but if so, it's going to be him. You know, if someone's going to do it, it's going to be him. Okay, so what we've seen at this point is the Jews follow through. Tatnai says, please, you know, go ahead and here are all your materials. Whichever kings were the ones who licensed this, the project is now complete. You make a great celebration that's modeled on these old celebrations. And it's for all of Israel. Note that phrase that's used in sentence 17, right? The Tzvurei Izin L'Chataah, you have these sin offerings, the goats that are brought for sin offerings for all Israel, meaning not only those who came back, but those who have not come back as well. The 12 tribes of Israel, everybody, yeah?
I'm a little bothered by the word exiles, Galutah.
Yeah?
Like, why did they call them? These are the people who returned from exile. Right.
Yeah, it's the ones who had come, right. It's the ones who had come back from it. The ones who had been the exiles.
Is it possible that also the exiles who remained also celebrated?
Yes, it's possible. I don't think it has to be there, but I think you could if you wanted to. But the Mitzvah David does make the point that it says for all Israel,
right,
suggesting that at least they have them in mind.
Right.
Okay, I wanted to get to discuss the Karbanos too, because there are some details. Shana already alluded to one of them, the sin offering element, and the question of why there's a sin offering. We're not going to get to everything, but I will note for you source number 11. Source number 11, the Medrash in Bamidbar Rabba, notes the fact that in each dedication we have a different number of animals. Some of them have a humongous number, Shlomo, right, obviously, and then some of them are smaller. So the Medrash in Bamidbar Rabba, and I only brought you an excerpt, there's a lot more there, says, it's quoting you from Tehillim Nun Aleph, that's the first chapter in Tehillim. Benefit Zion at your desire, God. Then you will desire the sacrifices of righteousness. Meaning, when they dedicated in the Midbar, right, as Dr. Berger mentioned, you just have a few. You have the Miluim, that's all you have in Parsha Shmini. You have a relatively small number of animals. What is this like? It's like the king who goes out on the road. And they give him a feast based on what they have on the road in that particular inn. The king says, that's what you bring me. Who do you think you're bringing this to? I'm the king. And they say, look, this is what we have. Right? When you go back into the land, then we'll be able to give you properly. When you go back to civilization, we'll be able to give you properly. So whatever we had at our disposal was what we brought in an attempt to honor God. But we still have to come back to the sin offering they brought and ask the question of what that's for. We also have to come back to the division of the Kohanim and Levim into the shifts as recorded in the Book of Moshe and what that means. But the key point that I really wanted to make sure to emphasize here is the legitimacy issue. We've talked about this quite a bit already, how they try to model things on earlier celebrations in order, earlier temples, in order to say, we are legitimate. We're not just Jews from Persia, who the Persians allowed to come back here, but we are the heirs of a very long and majestic tradition. And so they're going to try to model it on what was done before. They know what Shlomo did. They know what Chizkiah did. They know what Yoshiyahu did. And they're going to do their best to mimic it. There's more to see. God willing, we will be back here next week and go further with it. And that's going to set the stage for Pesach, their Pesach, before ours. And then finally, we'll set the stage for Ezra's arrival in Israel. Thank you.